So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight.
Listen to review,
right now, right? That's what you say. We get it by now.
Tonight, you're going to win the World Heavyweight Championship. You'll be the most powerful athlete in sport.
Ric Flair has signed now his son David and Kevin Nash for the world title.
Not only that, we're going to put lumberjacks all around the ring. If you jump over to our side, lumberjack style, I'll legalize that elbow drop, brother.
Big Sexy, tonight's going to be your worst nightmare ever. Ooh, yeah.
I think you've cut a deal here.
I think we need three more people. We need some strength, like Bam Bam. And Diamond Dallas Page. And you know what? That new kid, Gang.
All these lumberjacks are mortal enemies of Kevin Nash's.
The referee is going to be Double A on Anderson.
David Flair, if you win tonight, you get the strap. But if I win tonight, I get Tori for 72 hours.
They're all attacking Kevin Nash. This has been an elaborate setup to get Kevin Nash in the ring. Kevin Nash has to fight off everyone. The taser put in the hands of David Flair, and Kevin Nash took it away. He's got the gun.
He's got everybody.
He's got Gorgeous George.
Where's he taking her?
Tori, smiling, walking out. He's going to walk out of here with Gorgeous George and Tori Wilson. Did you see in that rearview mirror?
I did.
That was Sting in the Hummer.
You and I, nobody else we meet.
I don't like negotiating with you.
I'll have your girl. You just make sure you have my strap.
I get what I want, you get what you want.
You're gonna get your strap now. Get her out of the limo right now.
Got her.
You're right. All right.
Surprise, honey.
Into the arena and hear the light.
Welcome to Review Away. I'm John Pollock. He's still waiting. How are you, Way?
Good, man. Oh, man. Oh, I can't lie. No, I'm fine. I'm just a...
Uh-oh. It's been a while since we've got one of these. What are you, Way?
No, I'm just fine. I'm okay.
I thought you were going to say you're tired. But you don't seem tired. You seem energetic to talk about Nitro from 99, an era that will never stop delivering moments that just continue to reap benefits years later.
I don't know about that, but they are moments. They are.
Way, be honest, what would you rather do every late Monday night? Would you rather cover a 3-hour Raw or a 3-hour Nitro?
From 1999?
Yes, from 1999.
Oh, 100% Raw. Oh, my God. Are you kidding me?
See, I lean Nitro because I feel you and I would get so much entertainment out of it.
No.
But I think the sheer act of watching it in the moment, knowing it's 3 hours, that would slowly kill me. But there's times I think that during Raw that I am slowly withering away and stating that, you know, it's like in your head as you're growing up, you have this list of all these things you want to do in your life. And it's during Raw that I start realizing I'm going to have to scratch some of those things off.
Yeah, I mean, I think at least the wrestling on Raw today is a bit better for the most part. I'm watching an episode like this, and I, there's just so much. Just so much.
Well, this was a time period where, you know, despite everything, despite WCW's world crumbling around it, this was still an extremely strong business period for the company at this point. Like, things were not as dire as they would be a few months later and into 2000. But this was the first time they had run the Georgia Dome since the finger poke of doom. And I did some research, Way. You want to know what happened to their business over the course of this six-month period?
Yeah, what happened?
So January the 4th, 1999, the night that they advertised the rematch from Starrcade of Bill Goldberg challenging Kevin Nash for the title. We all know how that went. It ended up with Hulk Hogan taking Goldberg's spot after Goldberg was arrested and taken across the street after allegations by Miss Elizabeth. And then we got the finger poke finish, which you can check in our Review Away archive. That night, Way, they drew 38,809 people and a gate of $930,000 and $930,735, a gate record for the company.
Wow.
What could one simple finish do to their return business? Well, they came back here on July the 5th of 1999, drawing 25,338, 19,000 of which was paid, and their gate shrunk from 930 to $594,745.
Jeez.
So you're looking at like 35 to 40% decreases here with attendance and their gate figures. So they did a number on Atlanta and their Georgia Dome business. And this would be the last time they'd run the Georgia Dome ever. They at least had the knowledge to realize our product is not ready to go into the Georgia Dome. So instead, Raw took it over later that year and drew 33,000.
Well, I mean, it was a number of incidents, right, that probably contributed to that.
Oh, it was an overall trend. I mean, WCW, you could say this was Kevin Nash's booking period where it was a disaster. If you think this Nitro was bad, this was the entire spring. This was the entire 1999 of WCW, and it just got worse and worse. Then Vince Russo and Ed Ferrara came in October, but I found myself very sad watching this, Way, because there still was a big audience watching this and willing to go, even with all the drops. I mean, you get 25,000 people in for a television show at the Georgia Dome.
Yeah, that's a lot.
19,000 paid. Mm-hmm. It's like they were so concerned that the WWF was kicking their ass at this time. Instead of just looking and saying, hey, we've got a core audience here, a really healthy audience. It's not where we were in 98, but this is more than manageable if we just fucking learn how to do pro wrestling again. So they attempted to do pro wrestling for the next 3 hours. And there was actually going to be more on this show, Way, because Dennis Rodman apparently pulled out of doing this show. We didn't get we didn't get Master P on this show. There was a lot of celebrity involvement at this time, so we were stuck with Megadeth.
What? Wait, they were supposed to be on the show, but they weren't?
Dennis Rodman was supposed to be on the show, and he ended up pulling out. And then ended up coming back and doing the match with Savage on pay-per-view the next month. And I believe this was when everything was falling apart with Master P and WCW after things didn't get off to such a great start. So this was the tail end of Master P's WCW run. It was time to set his sights on Toronto Raptors basketball.
Maybe that's why people didn't show up for the Georgia Dome. That's why they lost all that audience, because of the failure of the Master P, No Limit Soldiers collaboration.
Yes. This show did a 3.28 rating, featuring their first hour, just so everyone can get the layout of their head-to-head battles. They had the first hour every week unopposed, and then hours 2 and 3 went up against Raw. So, as you can imagine, the first hour was very strong in comparison to the other hours, and the third was not very good. So we started off the show with a recap of last week's show, where David Flair is going after the WCW title against Kevin Nash in a lumberjack match, because at this time, Ric Flair is the president of WCW, the heel president, and Roddy Piper is his vice president, RPVP.
Mm-hmm.
And they are – Rick is being the – he is using nepotism here to advance his son's career and try and get him into title matches, knowing he is not worthy of doing so. And then in this recap as well, Randy Savage promised that this night will be Kevin Nash's worst nightmare, which was probably true when Kevin Nash was booking this throughout this time period. Every week was a nightmare. So then we learned that Nash would put up the title. This was on last week's Nitro. And if he retained his title, he would get Torrey Wilson for 72 hours.
Sure. Yeah, it's just
Torrey was on the line. And at the end of the match, he takes Gorgeous George, the valet of Randy Savage, and Torrey willingly leaves with Nash. So we have only one instance of kidnapping here. It's a hostage situation now to get his title back, taking George. And they end up meeting in a street somewhere. And they think they've retrieved Gorgeous George, who's in a hoodie. But it's revealed as Torrey. And then we cut off, and there is Sting inside of the Hummer, watching on. This was last week's Nitro. This was just the recap of what you missed last week. 3-hour show, and this was the key to it all. A hostage situation in order for Kevin Nash to get his title back.
Hostage situation. Yeah, I guess. I mean, and I guess, I suppose, like, it just really takes me back to that time in 1999 where I feel like anybody out there could justify kidnapping a woman in exchange for a title shot as a babyface act. And I guess at the time it was perfectly acceptable. It was different.
So I imagine, Wei, coming off of all of the heat coming out of this hostage angle, Kevin Nash sat down and thought, man, where can we take this Randy Savage, Gorgeous George angle and make it more offensive to people? How can I possibly do that? We would get our answer in tonight's show. The Nitro Girls perform. It was funny to watch all these women, Wei, who were just the Nitro Girls here, and just about all of them would end up becoming wrestlers over the next year once Vince Russo came in. And they showed this overhead shot showcasing the empty upper deck and half the dome cut off. A very unflattering shot of this stadium.
I guess. I don't know. I have nothing to say about that. The whole show was an unflattering shot to me. I don't know if you could tell, but I didn't enjoy this experience at all.
I'm really getting that vibe from you 10 minutes in.
Yeah, this was one of the tougher ones.
Do you know who attended this show live? Brian Mann.
Oh, wow.
Yes.
Okay, cool. I'd love to hear his thoughts.
He's not willing to talk about it, I don't think. No. Tony Schiavone and Bobby Heenan are the announcers for the show, and they note that Bret Hart will address the crowd for the first time since the passing of Owen Hart. And Heenan, what did he do here? He called him Jimmy and then corrected himself. And then Heenan explains what the 4th of July is. He states it's where redneck hillbillies get drunk and then you hand them explosives. It's quite the simplification of the 4th of July. And then we started the show off with Juventud Guerrera against Chavo Guerrero. So at least we were going to get a great cruiserweight match in 1999. And instead we got maybe the best analogy for WCW in 1999. Chavo Guerrero, with all the promise in the world, came out and tripped over himself on the ramp and just lay there. Sat there on his ass, looked around at these 25,000 people, shook his head and said, "The fuck am I doing?" That, everyone, was 1999 WCW in 5 seconds to start off this show. Hoovy is riling up the audience. He hit a missile dropkick to Chavo. Then the Hoovy driver is avoided and Chavo goes to the floor. And Tony Schiavone announces We have signed some big matches for Bash at the Beach, but we can only imagine what this Sunday has in store for Kevin Nash. This is the WCW champion on the final Nitro before the pay-per-view. And what a job they would do on this show of really preparing you for Bash at the Beach on Sunday. There was a gory special by Chavo, as he had the advantage. Then Chavo did this scoop slam, comes off the top into the feet of Hoovy. And then Hoovy bridges out of this jackknife cover. There's a German with Hoovy landing on his feet into a wheelbarrow, countered into a bulldog by Hoovy. And then there was a version of the Hoovy driver, which looked closer to a tombstone. And Heenan says, I don't think he's going to get up, as Chavo immediately gets up from this devastating maneuver, stopping Hoovy on the turnbuckle. And then the tornado DDT is blocked by Hoovy. Hoovy kicks out of a gourd buster. And then it's been enough time for the cruiserweights, because now Sid and Randy Savage have decided it is our time to take over the show. And Sid is wearing the stolen WCW championship as they run in. They kill both men. Sid powerbombs Chavo. It's a no contest. And then Savage comes off the top and kills Hoovy with a top rope elbow while wearing his silver sparkled button-up shirt and black pleather pants.
Yeah. I thought they were having a pretty decent match. And, you know, Hoovy, I think, first, you know, of all the cruiserweights, I thought he was one of the more charismatic ones. But it didn't matter. Didn't matter. Whatever the storyline these guys had, it was meaningless.
Can you imagine coming out and trying to have a good match knowing this is the finish? Mm-hmm. Like, how could you get into this review way if you already know ahead of time that the file's going to be corrupted at the end of this?
Yeah, well, that's a very nice modern analogy of a bad WCW cruiserweight match.
They came out and had, like, a good match here, knowing that it's not going to mean jack shit in 10 minutes' time.
Maybe they didn't tell them.
keep the finish away from them. We want to get the best out of these guys. Yeah. Nothing would surprise me at this time. Then we got, you know, in the history of this time period where the opening segment promos just became a staple of every show, I really feel a way I could put this one up against any other as maybe the worst. There were Sid chants from this crowd. He had just come back to WCW after a surprisingly good run in ECW, where we've reviewed shows at that time period where he was very well protected, got over in front of that ECW crowd, and then WCW scooped him up here the month prior. So Sid is still over here, and he gets on the microphone. Mistake number one.
I know you can hear me, Big Stitcher! And I know the world can see what we just did! And the thing is, I want everybody to take a close look and remember, because what me and the Macho Man do were examples, and examples you can follow. See, Big Sexy, my dad told me one time that suffering builds character. And me and the Macho Man, we figured you got a lot of damn suffering to go through. See, what you've done, you've messed with this man's man. This man's mind, excuse me. You see, you don't want to be responsible for an individual's sanity. Because when you do, things go wrong. Right, Macho Man?
He says that what he and Savage do are examples, and examples you can follow. He then spits and says that his dad, Father Vicious, told him that suffering builds character, and he predicts that Kevin Nash has a lot of suffering to go through. And then says, you've messed with this mind's man. Before he corrected himself. Mm-hmm. You've messed with this mind's man. Savage goes to speak, and he just tosses the microphone away. So Sid continues. And then Kevin Nash appears on before he appears, Sid explains that Kevin Nash is laying on a bed of coals and has no one to piss on him because no one cares. Man.
Okay, I get it, I guess. Oh, man, these are like... Have you heard that saying?
I've heard the, you know, I wouldn't piss on him if he was on fire. I've heard that line before. It's not a great line, but this was not that line. This was Kevin Nash being on a bed of coals and has no one to piss on him. Anyway.
It would be some relief if you're lying on a bed of coals and, I mean, you'd be really hot and then some...
To be honest, whether you are on fire or on a bed of coals, piss is not going to alleviate that burning. That's not going to put out the flames or subdue the heat.
Right.
Anyway, I really want to see Sid in a battle rap after this. You messed with this mind's man.
Mm-hmm. Of all the Sid quotables, this one kind of gets lost, but, you know, wasn't as bad as some of the legendary ones.
I have half the brain that you
do. Yeah, what's wrong with him? What's his, does he have a mental problem? Is he, does he have, a verbal form of dyslexia or something? What?
Well, he couldn't spell psycho, right? With Psycho Sid, it was S-Y-C-H-O and W-W-F.
Well, at least that's branding, but, this guy obviously, he's got a mental problem. Remembering the order of words, I think.
Maybe he just thinks too fast.
Maybe.
And you just get your words jumbled. So Kevin Nash then appears on screen. This was an awful idea because this was an obvious pre-tape where they were supposed to play off of one another.
I'm not so sure it was a pre-tape. Because
you don't think because so? There were these awkward... you're right. It could have very well been live, and it was just as disastrous.
It was like a CNN Skype call.
Yes. From a company attached to CNN in Atlanta. So Kevin Nash is wearing an Atlanta Wild jersey, along with Tori.
Was it not a Thrashers?
You're right. It would have been the Thrashers at this point. Why am I saying the Atlanta Wild? You're right. It would be the Minnesota Wild. Are they not the team?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. The Atlanta Thrashers. So he's with Tori, proposes a match with Sid, and says he's a little tired from last week because, you see, he's been having sex with Tori. So Savage then tries to react. Thanks. And he says,
"Come on, smartass!
You know, that profanity is really getting a little old, Buster. And I've got your girl. Let's not forget about that.
Don't let me know where you live. This is your last hurrah, your last picnic. You understand that, Nash?
Yes.
No more big sexy, brother. You're just Nash.
Yes.
You're all Nash, and that's it for you. This is it. I am the end for you. You understand that?
Let me ask you a question. Probably wonder where your girl is? You wonder where George is?
I want to know where George is, you stupid idiot. Yeah, I do.
You want to know? She's getting dressed right now.
There is no more big sexy. You're just Nash. And then Savage spits at the camera, pretending that this camera would digest the spit and it would land on Kevin Nash.
Yeah.
Into his secluded area.
I feel bad for the camera guy there.
It's like, motherfucker, I'm not Kevin Nash, and I have no portal to Kevin Nash's face. So then Gorgeous George walks into the shot with Nash wearing a Kevin Nash shirt, and it just ended. This was so awful. This was so terrible, this segment.
And we're to assume that Kevin Nash wrote this for himself?
Yes.
So I'm,
or at least directed this vision.
Yeah, so I'm going to kidnap your girlfriend, and your girlfriend, even though she's unwilling to be kidnapped, I'm going to then rape her, and she's going to enjoy the rape so much that she will not want to leave. And that is my hero's journey.
Yes. So he won Tori, who apparently Tori was more than happy to join Nash, and then Gorgeous George. Now we're to believe is there against her will, though we're not sure.
No, it is. I mean, she's happy, isn't she? Isn't that the
she
idea?
She seemed happy here. I mean, she was wearing a Kevin Nash t-shirt.
All right. Yep.
I thought this segment was awful, and this was your main event.
Yeah, it sucked. It just sucked. I thought it was an argument for scripted promos because there are so many awkward silences in between, and trying to communicate between the screen and the ring with all the delays just made this extra shitty.
Don't try and get into this minds, man. Oakland welcomes Ric Flair and David, and Oakland notes somewhat of a cool reception tonight, Rick. And Rick says he's been looking for his mojo since this morning. Because apparently that is the gimmick for every character in the main event scene. Lots of sex. He says he's the president of the strongest, largest, and most wealthiest wrestling company in the world, which would mean a breach of contract if he is in fact running the WWF. And he wants the U.S. title given to David because he beat Kevin Nash by countout last week. Therefore, he's the number one contender. Scott Steiner is hurt and states, "I put it on Big Dave." If nothing else, does Nitro prove that prior to Batista, Ric Flair had another Big Dave, and it was his son?
Wow.
And he's going to make him a Triple Crown champion.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, for all the critiquing of James Ellsworth, James Ellsworth is, I would say conservatively, a million times more over than David Flair was in 1999. 100%.
Are you kidding me? 100%.
Holy Christ. This was so, like, David was so scared on television here. Like, he looked frightened to be in front of all these people. And I don't blame him. Yeah. He had nothing to base this career on other than, I'm doing this.
James Ellsworth probably has way more hours in the ring.
14 years he's been wrestling. Yeah. So, I mean, you can say that this thing has a short shelf life, but this guy, it's not even comparable at all. I shouldn't even.
No, not at all. I mean, I think the James Ellsworth thing has been quite enjoyable. David Flair is just.
I will say
he was fine afterwards, but
David did get better when he did the whole psycho character. I mean, he did find a character that worked for him, even though he was extremely limited as a performer.
I think Rick could have had a very young Charlotte in this role, and it would have probably been better.
Well, she would have been about 13 at this time.
It would have still been better.
She could have faced Kevin Nash.
She would have had more. I guarantee you, she would have had more personality.
Well, she probably was doing gymnastics at this time, so probably could have at least put together some interesting spots.
Yes.
Charles Robinson comes out with tons of women, because you know what Charles has been doing with all the women, way
having sex. Yes.
So, Rick hands over the title and tells the women to have at it on David.
Yeah, right there in the ring in front of the world in the Georgia Dome and on live TV with all your clothes on. Yeah, just have at it.
Okay, Rick was awesome here because it was amazing how much charisma Rick had that David didn't get a millimeter of. Because Rick is standing there like a statue. Rick is dancing around. He's singing, "They'll be coming round the mountain when they come." I mean, Rick was just, he was making up for everything else in this ring. Then out came Buff Bagwell, who is in awe of his own physique during his entrance and wearing the ugliest skin-tight shirt you have ever seen. He comes down to the ring. And we go to the rafters where all these balloons are coming down. And I was like, this is really weird for Buff's like running. And I realize the balloons were late for David's U.S. title celebration because the balloons are red, white, and blue.
Yes, yes, yes.
Oh, this company sucked. They were
The fact that they even invested the money into the balloons and the pyro, and there was just so much spent on this show, I think. And I guess, granted, 1999, you could have justified it a bit more, but so much money on just bullshit that didn't matter. Michael Buffer, Megadeth, you know, there's a lot of production.
I looked this up, okay? The gate, I told you, was just under 600,000. This show, this singular Nitro, cost over $1 million to produce with all that stuff you just listed. They actually found a way to lose money here.
Like, ridiculous. And I guess I wouldn't be upset if, like, the segment was good. But it feels like there was so little care put into the production and the writing of the segment that I think spending even $10 on a pack of balloons from a dollar store would be – I mean, I guess that would be an expensive balloon set. But even the cost of the air and the balloons wasn't worth what the segment produced.
Well, Buff is out and he calls them – the triple D's with all the women out here, but is referring to, I guess, Ric Flair, David Flair, and Charles Robinson as dumb, dumber, and dumbest, which, granted, this is, I felt stupid for even giving it this thought, but don't you think the joke would have been better as just calling, saying, look at all these double D's out here, and we've got dumb and dumber in Rick and David? Did we have to include Charles for this triple D's joke? I mean, it didn't even...
He's part of the group, though. Is he not?
Yeah, he kind of just had no role in this segment at all. Anyway, this was way too much thought for this. Bagwell does get a pop because it's Atlanta, his hometown, and he wants a United States title shot. And he asks if David has any guts because you don't have a body. And Rick accepts it. Accepts on behalf of David and calls David John Elway, and these are the Denver Broncos. And then Buff does his pose and calls for his music because he shouts to the camera, it's better, his posing with his music, to which no music was played. This was a production masterpiece from the brain trust that was WCW, from the balloons, no music here. This was just something else to watch. Then we had a random Kevin Nash montage.
They did a lot of these music montages, and I guess that was sort of a – you would see more of these in WCW than WWE, because I think in the WWE you usually get like a voiceover and like something. They would try to tell a story. Whereas I guess these, they would just kind of tell them straight with video clips, or in the case of – some of them just like they were almost like music videos, you know, like a YouTube compilation that a fan would have edited.
At the end of this show, this go home show of Nitro, do you have any idea what the main event at Bash at the Beach was?
Okay, I'm going to say it's something involving Sid because he's the champion. And is it Sid and it's not Sid Nash because that was the main event here.
This is a wonderful endorsement of this go-home show that you just watched.
Who is it? Sid and, I don't know. Fuck. I have no idea. Who is it?
It was Kevin Nash and Sting against Sid and Randy Savage with the stipulation that whoever got the pinfall wins the title.
Gotcha. Okay.
That stipulation was never explained, and there was one comment in passing by Tony Schiavone of what the main event was. The main event of the pay-per-view.
Yeah, I didn't even think of that. Is the fate of the girls involved somehow? I thought that was the prize, not the title.
I'm sure they were involved in some way. Well, the thing is, Kevin Nash would lose the title to Randy Savage on the pay-per-view. And then next week on Nitro, Savage would lose the title to Hulk Hogan.
Oh, okay.
In case you wanted to take this review away and continue in the Chronicles of July 99.
Oh, so many people are like begging for these Nitros to be uploaded to the network. And I'm like, have you seen a Nitro lately from at least this time? I don't know how many people are buying the network to sit down and go through all this.
Every Nitro is now up. Every Raw and Nitro are now up on the network. So if you want to go crazy with WCW in 99 and 2000, go back and check them out.
Yeah.
I lived through them once. I'm not dying to ever do it again. And this show was a great reminder of that thought. Television title match. Rick Steiner the real estate agent who shares a birthday with yours truly, against Vampiro.
Okay.
As featured on Retrospective, a George Barbosa Wei Ting joint.
That's right. That is right. So he's a real estate agent now.
Yes. Pretty successful one, I believe.
Wow.
Yep.
Cool.
A guy who had a career after wrestling. Good for him. Yeah. Shivani alerts us. This has nothing to do with the quality of this show, I am sure. That even though it's just this Sunday, Bash at the Beach tickets still available. Shocking, huh? Think of this as well, Wei. A year ago, Bash at the Beach had that huge match with Karl Malone and Dennis Rodman teaming with Hogan and DDP. And it was the Nitro in the Georgia Dome, July 4th weekend, where Goldberg won the title from Hogan. I mean, that was 1 year ago. And yeah. Here we are.
Hmm.
Rick Steiner walked down the aisle, and of course Scott is hurt at this point, so Scott's not on this show. This poor fan thought his sign would go to waste, but no. He got it up here as Rick came down, as the sign read, "Hey Steiner, got roids?" Which I would imagine was not meant for Rick.
Yeah.
That's just a guess on my part.
Oh, I can't believe that. Did they focus on that?
Dude, some of the signs on this show, like there's nothing more... I'm sure there's Twitter accounts that exist, but you could do 1999 wrestling signs and run a very successful Twitter account, because they never cease to amaze me from this time period. You don't get signs like this too often anymore.
Yeah, they would confiscate them. But
Shivani,
sorry,
Shivani, go ahead.
No, I was going to say this was a Rick Steiner at his time in his career where he was trying to adopt his brother's gimmick.
Yeah, he was doing the heel badass character cutting, with his catchphrases.
Cutting promos like his brother, even dyeing that part of his goatee to like the reverse of what Steiner would do or Scott would do.
You don't like me? Bite me!
And it felt very forced, you know? Like with Scott, I guess because we saw it with him first, it felt a little bit more natural, or as natural as, you know, a 40-something-year-old saying, "Holler if you hear me," could sound. But with Scott, it felt even more forced.
So right after Tony Schiavone noted that tickets are still available, I would imagine fans watching in Jacksonville, the site of Bash at the Beach, maybe they're on the fence. They're like, "Ah, do we want to go this Sunday? I mean, yeah, there's going to be a... I'm sure there will be a main event. We just don't know it." But then Schiavone notes that if Rick Steiner gets past Vampiro, he will defend the title against Van Hammer this Sunday. And then, I mean, the decision was kind of made for you that your Sunday is going to be taking place at Bash at the Beach.
Oh, my
Van Hammer. That's the pay-per-view match.
Oh, man. Oh, my God.
Have we reviewed that show?
Don't even suggest it, please. Whether we have or haven't, I need at least a year away from this era, okay? Like I can't dive right back in. No. This was only a 2-hour show. At least like in content, it was a 2-hour Nitro, and I've had my fill for the year, I think.
There was a released German delivered to Vampiro. Didn't Vampiro talk about Rick Steiner in the interview you guys did?
I don't recall. I don't remember. It was a while ago.
Yeah. There was a pop-up powerbomb and a bulldog off the turnbuckle, and then Rick applies this submission with Vampiro's leg over his neck and then pulls on the arm. He submitted Vampiro in 1 minute and 20 seconds.
I was very surprised.
Poor Vampiro.
I thought Vampiro was a bit more valued than this at this time.
No. And one of the most annoying things, this was only 1:20, Heenan kept calling Vampiro Bella. As in Bela Lugosi.
Oh.
It's like, oh my God. It's okay. Like, what a great description of your goth character.
So, but like Vampiro at the time, at this time he had nothing going on, but like the match with Sting and like some of the bigger things, they wouldn't happen until later, right?
I thought Vampiro was never a great wrestler, but he had a great character.
Mm-hmm.
And this guy, to me, was always more over than his push in WCW. And then, I mean, he got more pushed when Russo and them came in and in 2000. But I mean, he had to do a lot of wacky shit in that. Like, you mentioned the Sting match with Sting falling off the Titantron, and I mean,
but at this time, I mean, you figure that he got into the company, and you figured he, you know, he would at least get some semblance of a push. But it seemed like if you're just watching this slice of Nitro, he, this guy was nothing more than just a jobber, a setup guy for Van Hammer.
Yep, that was the pecking order at the time. Yeah, he didn't really have much going on at this point. And then he'd hook up with the with Jerry Only and the Misfits in the fall. So he'd get more with the new regime than he did here. But yeah, this was just – he was nothing. He was just a guy on the show. Then we had – this was an interesting storyline at the time. Lenny and Lodi are in the back.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my gosh. This is the best present ever.
I knew you'd love them, Lenny. Hey, it's your favorite colors.
I know I don't need to try them on. You know all my measurements.
Lenny, I know every inch of you. Look, I know you're still nervous about last week and what we talked about. WCW is not going to mind when they find out.
Well, I know I can't lie to you. You know me like a book.
I've read every page. Trust me, Lenny. They're open-minded. They're not going to care.
If you tell me to trust you, then trust you I will.
And Lodi has got him matching trunks because Lodi knows Lenny's measurements and says he knows every inch of Lenny. And then Lenny's worried about WCW finding out. And Lodi says WCW won't mind. He says they're an open-minded company and they trust them. And as they walk off, we do a zoom in on the door of which they walk through that is labeled closet behind them. 1999.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they actually, after this segment, wanted them off television because this was too...
This was too risque?
This was too risque, oh, okay.
I guess. I mean, you know, it's not a... There's no kidnapping and...
They literally did a domestic violence angle on this show, and yet at the end of this show, this was the angle that was of concern to them.
Mm. Amazing. I think that there are great sociology projects you could do just on 1999, 2000 WCW, and I guess wrestling in general, but wow. Okay.
I thought these two were great together, though.
Sure.
I mean, this was these two were... To me, very much the influence that they got for Billy and Chuck years later.
Yes.
And I thought Lenny and Lodi, I mean, they didn't go very far with these two characters. Mm-hmm. But I thought the two were great together.
Yeah. Are there still any kind of pseudo homosexual characters like this anymore in wrestling? Like, do they still exist or are we completely past that time now? Like, did these types of characters exist in any current companies?
Is there
How about like Japan? Is there anything?
I mean, they had the deal with like Razor Ramon Hard Gay, who was very popular for a time period, but not anymore.
Yeah. So like, I feel like maybe now even something like this wouldn't be as effective. Well, I mean, certainly, I guess not as politically correct.
Oh, you could not. You could not do this today mm-hmm. and make this any kind of a taboo topic at all.
Right.
I mean, it was weird just going back and watching this. This was considered risque at the time by WCW.
Mm-hmm. What would be the equivalent? Like, what would be something that wrestling company you could see attempting right now that would kind of be as provocative?
You mean like topic?
Yeah, I guess like they haven't done transgendered characters yet. Have they?
No. I mean, there's always been, you know, transgendered characters in Mexico, but that's really not something popular on the U.S. scene. I mean, you've had Lucha Underground's done it. Yeah,
okay,
but there are no regular characters.
Huh. Mm-hmm.
Then Brett comes out. Oh, sorry. First, we had a video, which is voiced over by Mike Tenay on Bret Hart going over the death of Owen Hart. This was a pretty nice video they did. Just kind of essentially at this time period, the last you had seen of Bret Hart was that famous Nitro in Toronto where they did the angle with Goldberg with the steel plate, and then Bret quit. And
what was that supposed to lead to?
Just a rematch down the road where, I mean, they were almost trying to do a playoff, not exactly of Montreal, but just that Bret was this disgruntled employee and they wanted people to think he legitimately quit. And there was media that believed he had actually quit from this angle. But he was actually hurt at the time and they just wanted to come up with some new ideas for him. And then he was supposed to go on Jay Leno and do some kind of a challenge or whatever. And it was while he was in the air that he landed and then found out about his brother passing away. So that would have been in May. And then he was just off TV this entire time. And this was going to be his first appearance since Owen had passed away. So there was no way you could bring this guy back as a heel, which was where they kind of wanted him positioned as after everything that had happened with Owen. Mm-hmm. And so Bret came out, got a pretty big reaction here. And he notes he's been given all the time he wants, so he's not going to rush himself. And he thanks all the wrestling fans. He says WCW has given him time to collect himself. He describes Owen and how no one could say a bad thing about Owen. He was his closest brother, and he was asked to come tonight by Eric Bischoff. And he thought he would want to talk about things, but he's unsure what he wants to do with his career and his life. He states he's now at a crossroads, and it might be time to move on. And the crowd booed this heavily and notes legends like Wayne Gretzky and John Elway, who are retiring this year. But they all got to leave their professions happy and says his situation sucks. And he says he doesn't know what's next, but wants to thank all the fans, the wrestlers in the locker room around the world. He says, I hope I wasn't too stiff. And that's about it. Thanks. Mm-hmm. And he left. And this certainly felt like, as he described, like he was given a microphone to go out there and talk.
Yeah.
And that's what this was. But there was obviously... I think everyone assumed he was going to be back. I mean, that was certainly the expectation at the time. But this was largely to put Bret on TV.
Right. I think I remember watching this at the time. Probably one of the few things I would have like checked out on Nitro. And I guess I remember still kind of being like this being kind of one of my first exposures to Bret Hart talking out of pro wrestling mode. Kind of not speaking, you know, speaking as his real self. And I guess this was also one of the first few times where we would see Bret basically kind of speak like this in a more reflective kind of, I mean, more of a, you know, I hate to use the word bitter because I think, you know, a lot of people describe him as that, but, you know, but he has reason, especially, you know, coming off of something like this. But I'm just saying, I feel like this was kind of like the beginning or closer to the beginning of the Bret that I think we would come to know in the public over the next decade plus, you know, and that's different from kind of the Bret that, you know, I guess I grew up with on TV, at least, you know, the guy who was the hero and all that, like everything kind of from this point onwards was just seemed like it was kind of negative for this man until, you know, his return.
Yeah. And there was actually some criticism of this, not what Bret said or anything like that. Nothing to do with Bret really, but the fact that WCW chose to put this segment, which was obviously very much, this was like a real life situation with the guy's brother dying, mm-hmm. and they put it right as Raw went on the air.
Yeah, yeah.
So it was there to combat people tuning over to Raw, which, I mean, if you want to look at this thing as, you know, you're just being ruthless for ratings, I get. But, yeah, I can also see how – I think Bret was actually alerted of this afterwards, and I don't think he was aware of the placement on the show of when Raw was going on. So, I mean, it was certainly – you could certainly say it was somewhat underhanded using this – strategically placing Bret in the same situation, much like what the WWF did the night after Brian Pillman's death.
Yeah, yeah, it's tricky. I mean, where else would they should they have put this to you know to avoid criticism?
Yeah, I mean,
I think you know, you're going to face criticism either way. To just even put Bret on air to do it, at all.
So Eddie Guerrero then comes up to Doug Dillinger backstage, and he complains that his wallet has been stolen. And he says someone was wearing a mask, and he needs Dillinger to round up all of the masked wrestlers, and he will be able to identify the thief.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
I will say Doug Dillinger hardly seemed like a competent head of security during these segments.
They didn't portray him too well.
It's like, Eddie, you know all these wrestlers. Just tell me who it was. Why do you need all the masked wrestlers to unmask if you've seen the unmasked man?
Oh, but he's saying that he hasn't seen them, though. Isn't that the idea? He's never seen these guys unmasked. So this was his way of basically, you know, getting these guys to reveal their true identities to him.
So he's never seen these wrestlers unmasked.
Yeah.
But during this one instance of a wallet being stolen, he did see the guy's face. Is that what we are to believe?
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. So, but that, okay, we'll discuss this later.
Well,
this
we'll
was a real
we'll analyze this.
We're going to spend an hour on that reveal. Ernest Miller. Oh my God. This, speaking of something that felt like an hour, Ernest Miller versus Jerry Flynn, not Lynn.
Yeah.
In a kickboxing match.
Yeah. How do you think those two have ever met? Or even wrestled each other?
I'm sure they wrestled each other.
Jerry Flynn, Jerry Lynn match?
Oh, the Jerry Flynn and Jerry Lynn.
Yeah.
I thought you meant Ernest Miller and Jerry Flynn.
No.
Well, I don't think there was ever a crossover between Mr. JL in WCW and Jerry Flynn. And Mr. JL would have been in the cruiserweight division, right. So unlikely. But if I was an indie promoter at some point, I would have totally booked that match.
How confusing. You think those – I mean, I would assume more so Jerry Flynn, but he must have been – like maybe he was like promoted on a bunch of indie dates and then everybody's like, oh, I can't wait to see this ECW guy. Oh, I remember – I can't – maybe they booked like Jerry Flynn versus RVD and everybody got really excited.
Who the fuck is this guy with a rat tail? Imagine if Jerry Lynn's middle name was Frank or something. It had an F.
Jerry F. Lynn.
Jerry F. Lynn against Jerry Flynn.
Oh, God.
Oh. Ernest Miller's theme music was changed on the network.
Yeah, I guess, like, what was...
Which makes no sense because Brodus Clay's is not.
No, but his other theme was, like, I'm the greatest. That was his WCW theme, wasn't it? Like...
Yeah.
Not somebody's... Somebody Call My Mama. That was Brodus Clay's. Hello?
Oh, what am I confusing it with? Because wasn't Ernest Miller's theme reused?
I think his WWE theme was used.
Oh, that's what I'm thinking of. You're right. Yeah.
So like the James Brown one he had in WCW, I suppose that was too close to maybe a real song or maybe contained a sample of something. I don't know. But. Yeah, they edited it out. Somebody else would be able to better educate us about that issue.
I'm almost sure they've used that I'm the Greatest theme, and they've used that to dub over other things on the network. I'm pretty sure.
I think they might have used the Brodus theme to
– Maybe. Maybe. Someone clear it up for us. But this like that theme, I was always of the impression, was an in-house theme that you wouldn't think would have had any legal restrictions to it. Both are in boxing gloves, so the match will be two-minute rounds. And we've got Sonny Ono in Miller's corner and Jimmy Hart in Flynn's corner. A regular Greg Jackson and Firas Zahabi.
Oh, of course. By the way, like they just start the match, and at least like I didn't recall, did they announce that like the rules of the match? Did they announce that this was even a kickboxing match prior to the start of it?
I'm sure Shivani noticed.
Shivani did, but if you're watching live...
Yeah. Oh,
you're
yeah.
Expecting you're expecting a wrestling match. All of a sudden, these guys just show up in like boxing gloves and this.
This probably timer. Was set up the week prior, I would think.
Okay, but how many people are like just stumbling into the arena, you know, or at least like not remembering what they watched the week before? Some of them probably didn't watch at all.
Now, remember the fact, Way. We just talked about how ruthless this ratings war was, that they put Brett's segment head to head with Raw. So they also put this head-to-head with Raw.
My God. Well, this wasn't even the worst of it. At least this was somewhat special, but God, like fucking Van Hammer is still to come.
This just was death. The crowd hated this. They were essentially just doing like a warm-up session together with these light kicks.
It was a sparring match.
Yeah. And that might be giving it too much credit. The announcers note that they have their hands up to defend a kick. It's like, cool, yeah. Heenan maybe had the best line of this. He says, at the end of the first round, the cat has a mouse under his eye.
That was good, yeah.
Then Miller started the second round with a cartwheel kick, and he's landing much more on Flynn. Enormous boos from this crowd. And then there's a spinning back fist as Flynn is down on a knee, and then he hits a spin kick to the body of Flynn, and nails him with a sucker punch as the bell is called and Flynn is declared the winner by DQ. And then Flynn fires back with a takedown and attacks him after the match and gets into the half guard of Miller's.
Yeah. This was interesting for me to watch just because I actually was curious to know how these guys kind of looked from their legit, you know, fighting backgrounds, and you got a chance to see a lot of their, I guess, real kind of techniques. And who did you think looked better as a kickboxer?
Do I have to pick?
Yeah.
Ernest.
Because Ernest Miller is what, karate, but he's done kickboxing? Is that it?
I think so, yeah.
And Jerry Flynn is like legit kickboxing. Like,
Yes. I mean, Miller did some, you know,
he got a couple knockdowns. He got a couple knockdowns. And do you think like those were legitimate or just staged?
No, but
I don't get why they would have had Jerry Flynn accept a couple knockdowns. Because wouldn't you want your babyface to be the one to deliver the knockdowns and then have the heel cheat afterwards to end the match? Here, it was Ernest Miller actually basically dominating. And then he just like threw the match by getting DQ'd. So what sense does that make?
I can't really tell you. I'm trying to look this up here, but you have to remember, Wei. I mean, this was WCW at a time period where if you have a logical question, just throw it out the window. Yeah. And honestly, Miller was the guy they were pushing, not Jerry Flynn.
Oh, okay. I guess. Yeah, the fans had no patience for this at all.
Next up was a graphic for Kevin Nash and Sid. Nash has his arms folded, and there is the worst Photoshop of this title over top his right shoulder with his arms crossed.
saying there's no logical Wei gravity would allow this title to...
There's no Wei it would have stayed on his shoulder with his arms crossed like this. I was like, we can't get a photo of the fucking Booker who's the world champion with his fucking title. That's not possible. The guy's had the title for 2 months.
Well, listen, they spent quite a bit on those balloons, so couldn't hire the photographer that day, I don't think.
Unbelievable. Then we got a shot of a fan with a Bill Goldberg bobblehead, and Shivani suggests we get a Bob and Heenan doll. And then he plugged something that I had Wei more interest in than Bash at the Beach. There would be a QVC special, which is like the Home Shopping Network, hosted by Randy Savage.
Oh, wow.
I would review that in a heartbeat. Oh,
100%. I wish we had that on the network.
If anyone finds that, please upload it. Lenny and Lodi come out, and Lodi here... plugging his website on his trunks, lodi-page.com.
Oh, how could you? Very easy to remember, the dash page.
Oh, what a. I'm surprised you didn't have GeoCities at this time in 1999.
Let me type it in.
I'm doing that now. Okay. Lodi-page. Oh, the site cannot be reached.
.net?
Oh, was that a .net?
No.
Oh,
okay. Lodi-page. Yeah.
Now, Lodi used to, you know, he basically took Sign Guy's kind of a gimmick here with the signs to the ring, which used to be a lot more wittier than these ones. Bobby the Brain is cool. One more Nitro win coming up. So I guess the creativity tapered off a little after the days in the flock. So that led us to Lodi versus Van Hammer in an unofficial advertisement for Raw. Hammer is in a singlet with a cross through the word peace.
He hates peace? He's anti-peace?
He's anti-peace.
What was his gimmick? I mean, he's a metal guy, but like, what else?
He's against peace.
He hates peace?
Yeah.
Like,
he's here to disrupt.
Oh, okay. That's what it means. I don't like harmony, and I need to show that. How do I show that? By being as literal as possible. I'm going to write the word peace on my singlet, and I'm going to put a big cross across it. Okay.
Oh, this was one of their many, many post-Bill Goldberg pushes for a monster. They did it with Wrath. They did it with this guy.
Jesus.
And they would do it with Sid later. I mean, it was just
all right.
Let's just say mixed results. And this guy, let us give honor to the one and only Scott Putski.
Oh, yes.
Holy Christ. This guy was in multiple area codes. This guy was so jacked and was like he had walked out of a microwave. He was so orange. This one guy who was facing the hard camera all night long, he had this sign: Diana, will you marry me? So she obviously was not watching, as he kept the sign up the entire show.
Man, how awful. I hope they're – I mean, first of all, I'd like to know if she said yes. Secondly, I'd like to know if they're still together, because if they could suffer through this episode being tied to their relationship forever, then I think they can weather anything in that relationship. I mean, imagine it. How did you get married? How did your husband propose to you?
Well, he didn't buy me a ticket to the show. Instead, I was watching Raw, and he called me to ask if I was watching Nitro, which I wasn't. So I flipped over to a fucking Van Hammer match and was asked a question that was life-altering. Of course I said no. This dork with his Diana, will you marry me? How about Diana, will you come to the show with me?
Oh,
this
he's
guy
scared.
Doesn't deserve to marry Diana.
No, I mean to go to this show, I think would have been a worse move. So she maybe looks at this like, wow, this man suffered through all 3 hours of this excruciating piece of shit to ask me to marry him. What won't he do for me?
Well, the answer was buy our ticket. There was a big boot by Hammer. He placed Lodi on the top turnbuckle and sent him off with a beel. Then Lenny helps him on the floor and gets water for Lodi. Hammer attacks him on the floor and throws Lodi into the barricade. Lenny then pulls the top rope, and Hammer just awkwardly falls over to the floor as Lenny attacks and returns him in. Lodi gets a one count. Then Lodi hit a Hurricane Rana and looked into the camera, and he had a stunning resemblance to Josh Koscheck here with his blonde hair. Lenny then gets onto the turnbuckle, takes a superplex, very impressive looking, I thought, and then a Cobra Cut clutch slam by Van Hammer, who won 4 minutes and 8 seconds. This went.
This was miserable. This was really tough. And, I mean, the match was just whatever, but it's exactly that reason. Like, it was, I guess if you really love superplexes, please go and check this out. Have a great time.
Hey,
man,
mean, it was
it's just nothing redeeming about this. And this was in the middle of a show that had very little redeeming qualities on its own. So to have to watch this match while knowing that I still had half of it to go, that's the worst. That's the worst part of doing these reviews. And I'm in the middle of a show that's long, and I have to sit through something that is I know is meaningless, completely meaningless. Like, we're talking about it now. I guess there's some meaning derived out of this, but beyond that, I know it's something I'm going to spend 5 minutes of my life on that is basically a waste of my very precious existence, my very precious time on this planet.
Doug Dillinger then rounds up the cruiserweights to explain how Eddie's wallet was stolen. This is the entire use of Eddie Guerrero on this show. So we round up La Parca, Lismark, Ciclope, and Viano 5. Then, in the crowd, Black Rob of Bad Boy Records.
Yeah, of Woe fame.
Of Woe fame?
Yeah, that was his big song, Woe.
Oh, okay. Was that off Life Story?
I don't know the name, I guess. Is that his only album?
No, he had four albums. He came out with Life Story,
yeah.
The Black Rob Report in 2005, then...
No, it would have been off of Life Story, because I don't think anybody listened to any of the other ones.
Yes. This is the best title of all his albums. Game Tested, Streets Approved.
Okay.
And then last year he came out with Genuine Article.
And obviously he's not... The other ones weren't Bad Boy at all, right?
No, he had a falling out with Bad Boy, I believe, shortly after this, didn't he?
I have no idea.
I'm the last person that should be explaining this to you. This guy had a stroke last year. Late 2014, early 2015, Rob suffered a mild stroke. He has since recovered.
Jeez.
I had to change my health regimen and how I eat. That's it. I'm exercising and trying to keep it up. I don't drink no more.
Okay, well, I wish him the best.
Well, he's doing better than WCW is. Then Gene Okerlund brought out Vice President Roddy Piper. And there is a long delay. Roddy was not ready for this segment. That was obvious.
Yeah, there was a long delay, wasn't there?
Okerlund, on the microphone to the 25,000 people, asks if he was in a bathroom somewhere. And then he finally comes out and... In a bit of a eerie line, just given the timing and everything, he said he jokes about being late that he'd be late for his own funeral.
Oh, man.
Piper then cuts this pro-Atlanta speech. He calls himself the original Highlander and the Braveheart of wrestling.
Did that just come out at the time?
Braveheart had come out years earlier, like 95.
So who's the current Braveheart of wrestling that he decided to use this reference for?
Oh, at this time? I thought you were saying now. I was like, maybe now it's Noam Dar, but I don't know. He says he eats thunder and craps lightning. He doesn't take money for throwing fights, but for throwing punches. Praises Curt Hennig and Bobby Duncombe Jr. for saving the youth of America because crap is rap and rap is crap. Which was either an unwitty line or a great save on his part, realizing he got it backwards. Yeah. Unlike Sid, who couldn't make a similar recovery. Crap is rap. So remember, this guy is... the heel authority figure with Flair at this time, too. I mean, he was...
It was very confusing. It was very confusing to me.
Because he started it off like he was just... like, this Atlanta crowd loved him. And then he had to turn things around.
Dude,
with...
the whole show, I really could not tell you for much of it. Like, who was the good guy? Like, is the guy who just kidnapped the girl and is, we're led to believe, is having his way with her. Is he the bad guy or the good guy? Or, you know, is the... The GM it was all over the place.
It was a company that saw the success of the WWF but had no idea why they were being successful. They just looked at Steve Austin and simplified it in, oh, the heel's the good guy now. It's like, no, Steve Austin is a babyface. He is a babyface.
He's standing up against authority, which is a heroic trait. And I guess having sex with a lot of women is a heroic trait as well. But I don't know the way that, gross.
So Piper has questions for Sting. He says he's never met the guy. It's like, what? You guys have been in the same fucking company for 3 years together. He calls him out, and a fake version of Sting comes out, much shorter. And Piper asks if Sting is aligned with Randy Savage and if he attacked Kevin Nash with the Hummer. We were in the post-Hummer angle era of Nitro. And this Sting denies it. And he asks Sting to take off his mask because he doesn't have a painted face. He has one of those fake masks.
Like a rubber mask. Yeah.
Yes.
It's a fake Sting.
Yes. It was actually Asuka underneath. And then Piper attacks him with a spinning neck breaker, rips off the mask and the hair. And Shivani notes, hey, the real Sting paints his face. And questions, hey, maybe it was a fake Sting in the Hummer last week. I then had to go to the hospital because I put my head through a window and it needed stitches. When I returned, Piper ended by then just, like, what a pivot here. He just starts cutting a promo on Buff Bagwell, and he makes a match for them this Sunday at Bash at the Beach, and for whatever fucking reason, it's going to be a boxing match with three-minute rounds because we just saw an awesome example of that a few minutes ago. And J.J. Dillon just comes out with Judge Mills Lane, who's just there just in case Piper decides to come up with the match off the top of his head and they want a fucking referee. And goddamn Mills Lane says he had one goddamn line. He had one line. Let's get it on Sunday in California, in Florida. Fuck. They were at least contenders for the worst promos of the night.
Oh, man.
God, was this stupid. And my God, did I not want to see a boxing match between Buff Bagwell and Roddy Piper.
So much happened here in such a short amount of time that it was just like,
what was going on?
Overstimulus. And you really have to kind of rewind this and maybe even watch it in slow motion just to kind of dissect every little thing. Like, not only did he make a boxing match for no apparent reason, he made a 10-round
rounder. It's 10 three-minute rounds. Wow. The threat of a 30-minute boxing match between these two.
Like I guess Piper kind of has a brawling kind of boxing-like style, but I mean, what else?
He did do boxing, but that was decades earlier.
Okay.
Bagwell, like, I don't
what?
Know.
And then, like, Judge Mills Lane shows up. He's, did he do anything with WCW prior, or did he just, like, this was his debut? Like, he's a TV judge, but he's also from boxing, correct?
Yes. Yes, the guy who popularized the let's get it on catchphrase, okay. That Big John McCartney.
So you
uses.
Figure like Dillon coming out, he'd at least like introduce Mills Lane before, you know, him coming out. Because he is like a bit of a celebrity. But here, like Mills Lane was just already in the background when the camera cut to Dillon. So it was like it seemed like no big deal at all. Like it seemed like he was just the background guy. It was so weird. It was really weird.
Yeah. As I looked this up, Bagwell had an amateur boxing career, which would have been great if that was ever brought up here.
When? When did he do that?
I guess years before he got into wrestling.
Well, he's done a lot in his life. He's boxed, he's wrestled, he's prostituted, yeah.
WrestleCrap has a great induction into their the very worst of pro wrestling, and this boxing match did make it, so you can check that out.
Oh, wow.
So, oh my gosh, this time period. I will give credit. Roddy Piper had to cover, like, so many different stories in this promo, and he did get from one to the other. I won't say any of the end results were anything I wanted to see, but, I mean, this went from him, like, praising Kurt Hennig and Bobby Duncombe Jr. to attacking fake Sting to setting up a match to his reaction that Judge Mills Lane would be the referee on Sunday. This all within like 7 minutes.
Oh, man. I'd love to see the rundown of that segment.
Doing what? maybe he was going over when Gene Okerlund called him out to the ring.
Yeah, that must have been why he was late. Shit. How do you transition from attacking a fake Sting to setting up a boxing match with Buff Bagwell?
By the way, Gene, I have more to get off my chest. So Conan, Rey Mysterio, Brad Armstrong, they came out next. And they do Conan does a promo wearing a Barry Sanders jersey. Rey shouts out,
"Oh yeah, let me pop my collar. Big ups to ATL in the house. Big ups to my boy Dominic and to Carlos and Sandy for tying their knots. Now can I hear the call of the soldier? Hoodie-hoo!"
Hoodie-hoo.
Boy.
Only Rey could get away with
yeah,
this.
Yeah, I mean, I know like the WWE Network is like known to edit stuff out. This would be under consideration for me if I was in charge of the WWE because I don't think I would want any fan, if Rey Mysterio was still under my employ, to see this side of Rey Mysterio who just – let's better we all forget it because, I mean, it was him unmasked looking like Dominic, you know, and – I suppose, like, at the time, yeah, urban culture, I guess, was really cool. And that meant coming out and just rambling, talking about things that maybe were inside references. And I suppose mm-hmm. it kind of worked for Conan. But with Rey, it meant shouting out your son, shouting out your friends who are about to get married. And that was it. Like, you had... There's nothing else. As long as you come out and kind of have some words coming out of your mouth and you wear a Tommy Hilfiger, then I guess you can hope that you seem cool.
So that led to a tag match with Conan and Rey Mysterio against Steven Regal and Fit Finlay. And this was great. There was another sign that just read, "No Limit, Conan and Rey Jr., spelt K-O-N-A-N, and R-A-Y Jr."
Wow.
There was also another... Yeah, I was
how
like,
do
wow.
How do you make that mistake? Maybe that fan is, like, blind. So they've never seen Conan and Rey Mysterio spelt, but...
They thought Rey, instead of meaning king, was short for Raymond. Raymond Mysterio. There was also a sign, "Steven Regal is my least favorite wrestler."
Okay, yeah, thanks. Thanks for letting us know.
Fit that all into one sign. There was a rolling fireman's carry by Finlay to Rey, and then a reverse chin lock, Boston Crab combo to Rey by the heels. Then Finlay missed and ran shoulder first into the corner as Conan tagged in. Conan hit a face buster to Regal, Bronco Buster by Rey, but then the West Texas Rednecks ran down, attacking the No Limit soldiers, and they joined in on the attack. Did Finlay and Regal, and the match is thrown out in 2 minutes and 39 seconds. What a night's work.
Well, yeah, just in case you were looking at the match card and getting a little bit excited.
I was like, oh, this could be fun.
Yeah. No, definitely not. I mean, the talent, look at the talent on this show. I mean, they still had the Radicals at the time. Even a match like this looked like it had potential, but nothing gets going. Yeah. It was just.
Are you going to make it? We're almost done. David Flair comes out in a robe with Rick, Arn, and Asia. And we cut to a sign. Like, the director made the call. Cut to that sign that read, and I quote, "David." David. Shivani calls him the most undeserving United States champion ever, and he defended here against Buff Bagwell. And, oh, David, he had dyed blonde hair with black and red pleather spandex shorts. He looked every awful 1999 fashion choice rolled up into one.
Did he have Adidas on?
Oh, man, you might have had a...
Maybe a choker. What else would people... Like spiked blonde hair, I guess he kind of had.
An Umbro jacket.
Ooh, is that a... Anyway.
Umbro was very big in this time period.
Yeah.
Yeah, he had to... he got the notice that this title match was going to be taking place in the next segment via his ICQ message. Bagwell starts posing, and he mocks David's physique. Great, great classic babyface technique. Flair then hits a low blow in the corner and then runs into a reverse elbow. Bagwell hits a blockbuster. I will say this. This crowd was really into Bagwell, and they wanted to see this guy win the title. Charles Robinson goes to count after the blockbuster, but then his shoulder goes out as he's counting. And then teases a figure four as Rick and Arn run in. Bagwell fights them off. He applies a figure four. Rick goes to stop the figure four, but Bagwell catches him with an inside cradle while still holding the figure four on. But then Rick and Arn stomp on Bagwell. Dean Malenko runs in for the save. Then Asia comes in. Bagwell scoop slams Asia, which did get a big reaction. And who should return? Roddy Piper, who clocks Bagwell with some object in his fist. And David Flair covers the unconscious Buff Bagwell in 3 minutes and 17 seconds. I will say the crowd did get into Bagwell. But this was very. This was quite the heavily booked 3-minute television match.
I think I don't think Buff Bagwell. I mean, I think he was. He's a good looking guy, great physique, and I think had a definite charisma about him. So you know, he gets a terrible rep because I don't. You know, because of not being known as a great wrestler. You know, the WCW. Debut on Raw certainly hurt him, but I definitely think like there's a lot of potential there. I think this feud didn't seem there's nothing to really like about the feud. There's really nothing to like about him as a hero beyond, you know, him being a good looking guy, I think, and doing like a dance that was entertaining. It's also hard for me to watch these without watching the whole storyline. But actually, maybe it's a little easier. Maybe if I had seen the entire storyline, I would be even more turned off.
Then the Nitro Girls did another dance, and there was this ominous voice on the loudspeaker to assist their dance number here, where the voiceover read, "Do you know that bad girls go to hell?" Very strange. Then Dillinger is with the cruiserweights. We got a shot of the boom mic over top of them as they form a line. And Eddie says he cannot tell who stole the wallet with their masks on. No shit. So he needs them to remove their masks. So we get the point of view of the cruiserweights with Eddie's reaction to each one as they are forced to take off their mask. And Eddie was pretty great here. The masks come off, and Eddie is just horrified at Ciclope asking if he was in a fire. He tells Lismark he's good looking and asks why he wears a mask. And next is Viano 5, and then Cheetah Kid, who I didn't even remember, is revealed as Prince Iakea. It's like, great. Well, this gimmick's done.
They didn't reveal.
Well, he said, "Hey, Prince Iakea."
Oh, did he say that?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought he just said, "Oh, I know you."
Yeah. It was. And then the last one is Blitzkrieg, and he just laughs and realizes it wasn't any of these guys. He just fucked around with them so they could unmask.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
I mean, if nothing else, this did show you the range of performer Eddie Guerrero was.
Sure.
Which you don't often remember from his WCW time as much. But this guy was a tremendous performer. Yeah. This was also when he was coming back after that awful car accident on New Year's Eve of the prior year.
I think it also showed you how little they thought of luchadors, you know.
Oh, yes.
They were really just kind of here as like jokes.
This was here for their own enjoyment, I think, more than anything like entertaining on the show.
Yeah.
It was just a division that they just looked at as, you know, a punchline.
These are the foreigners who can't speak English.
Hardcore Hack, the Sandman, cut this promo on top of a ladder along with his valet Chastity and says he choked out the doctor that delivered him. And they had this weird static effect on this video. He explains that all he knows what to do is fight. He's been in jail many times. He says WCW was stupid enough to hire him. And he lists off all the people he's hurt and yells over the fact that Ric Flair is not sanctioning his matches because they're too violent. So that sets up the infamous junkyard match for Bash at the Beach on Sunday. And he calls out every tough man on the planet. And Chastity ends the promo and sends you back to your regularly scheduled programming as we go to static. And this would be one of the all-time legendary awful matches in WCW history, where guys fought in an actual junkyard. People got injured. It was shot terribly. It was in the dark.
Wow.
Another reason to buy this pay-per-view.
Okay.
Then it was the live performance. We weren't going to have just one band perform in the Georgia Dome. We had two, with the West Texas Rednecks performing Rap is Crap. And the West Texas Rednecks consisting of Kurt Hennig, Barry Windham, Kendall Windham, and Bobby Duncombe Jr. And this was done with the idea that these are these heels railing against the No Limit Soldiers. But in fact, this ended up becoming pretty popular. Some country stations even started playing this song. So Hennig starts it off before playing the song by noting the VIP section and listing off guys like Hank Williams Jr. that are there, then spits out his gum.
Were they actually there?
I don't know. These were names that, I mean, Mark Wills, Mark Chestnut, John Anderson, not names I would be lying about if they weren't actually there. So I'll take Kurt Hennig for his word. He did the gum thing and just nailed it.
Oh, and he did it so like nonchalantly, you know? He had a guitar strapped to him. He was in the middle of talking and just like just spat it out and just like it was perfect.
There is zero debate. This was the best stuff Kurt Hennig ever did in WCW, was the West Texas Rednecks. Then he asks, how many good old boys are out there? And this got a pretty good reaction. Then he says, well, let me ask how many rednecks are out there. And this place went nuts.
Yeah.
Here in Atlanta. So then he asks how many people hate rap music. And then they go to perform the song. At the end, there's pyro. There were a few boos, but this crowd largely enjoyed this way. Like, these guys were baby faces to this audience.
Yeah, I think for good reason. They were very entertaining. And I think there are a lot of people that hate rap, or at least don't identify with it. So, yeah. To me, this was a highlight of the show.
I thought Black Rob was going to storm the stage.
Oh, I thought they would definitely cut to Black Rob to show his reaction. You know? I thought that would have been great. Are you going to talk about the performance?
No, you go ahead.
Well, to me, honestly, the highlight of this entire broadcast, the only redeeming value of this entire broadcast, is seeing Barry Windham pretend to play the pretend to play the drums.
Yes.
And the look on his face as he's like essentially like air drumming. It's the best. It's great. I thought, as far as fake playing goes, I thought Bobby Duncombe Jr. did a great job on the guitar. He mimed that plucking very well. And I just love knowing that these guys shared a stage with Megadeth and got a better reaction. Bobby Duncombe Jr.'s guitar playing got a better reaction than Dave Mustaine, which is awesome to me.
So, yeah, this segment was great. I really enjoyed this. The West Texas Rednecks, like a perfect example of something that was never meant to get over in the way it did. And, of course, they never capitalized on it. It went nowhere, unfortunately. They then came out with a follow-up song called Good Old Boys.
Southern born, southern bred. When I die, I'll be southern dead. We like to watch our wrestling every week on TV. Our favorite show is Andy Yummy Berry.
It's good old boys. Good old boys. Good old boys.
but it didn't have the same popularity as Rap is Crap. And people still remember this to this day. This is one thing where I think if you were to ask people great WCW moments of 1999, the West Texas Rednecks would probably be in your list, I would say.
You know who should reunite to kind of do a new generation? Would be Bo Dallas, Curtis Axel. Who else? Yeah. Yeah. Their dads were doing this.
Barry Windham could come in.
The uncle, yes. Yeah.
This could be a future Curtis Axel gimmick here, singing. So then we got another great Savage and Sid montage done to Savage's new theme song. No announcement, just a random video, as per usual in WCW montages. Diamond Dallas Page, Bam Bam Bigelow, and Chris Kanyon against Chris Benoit, Dean Malenko, and Perry Saturn. These guys were involved in a feud at the time where they were building up to Page, Bigelow, and Kanyon were doing the Freebirds deal as the Jersey Triad with the tag titles, and were going to be defending the titles against Chris Benoit and Perry Saturn at the pay-per-view on Sunday. Benoit hit a bunch of rolling Germans to Kanyon. They went through a commercial break. They got the heat on Saturn. Page then was clotheslined down. Benoit tagged in, attacking Bigelow with chops and an enziguri. Benoit went to the top and Page crotched him. People were actually throwing garbage at the ring during this match. Crowd was chanting for Goldberg. They seemed very restless. There was a bear hug by Bigelow onto Benoit, who then tried for a sunset flip, and then Bigelow missed with the seated splash. Everyone comes into the ring. Malenko and Saturn both apply small packages, but there's kickouts. Kanyon hit a tombstone, went for a tombstone, and Malenko reversed it, and he hit the tombstone. Bigelow then missed a headbutt off the top, breaking that up, and then Saturn with a splash off the top, followed by a Benoit diving headbutt, and he pinned Bigelow. I thought this was easily the best match on the show, but not a whole lot of candidates way.
No, but definitely the best match on the show. And you could see, like, I feel like it's very easy, you know, for watching a show like this to just not be motivated to do anything, like to have great matches, like especially if you're in the position of like a Chavo or a Hoovy, you know. I guess, like, I don't know, but you saw guys like Benoit here still like working really hard, working their asses off for matches that, you know, could easily get lost in the shuffle of the entire show. But
and this did.
It did, yes, which it did. But you know, you could, I guess you could tell that these guys were still highly motivated to show their value and try to get over via wrestling.
And that was such a killer, because those guys that were going out there and working hard, like, look at how they would fare over the next 6 months with the loss of Jericho, the Radicals. I mean, that was a big loss for WCW, was losing kind of that heart of your mid-card that could go out there and at least have good matches, even though everything surrounding it was pretty dismal at the time and they weren't in anything meaningful. I mean, they would have a great – I remember these tag matches. They did a Great American Bash one and then followed it with this Bash at the Beach one, and both are great matches. But, yeah, there was very little going on for these guys. Michael Buffer, your favorite, is in the ring for his one match of the night.
Oh, sorry. You had the actual segment, the Goldberg segment.
Right. I watched this at the end of the show. Okay. But this is when the Goldberg segment ended. So right after the West Texas Rednecks, like 20 minutes later, we get Megadeth, who performs Crush 'Em off the new Universal Soldier movie that Bill Goldberg was in.
And we should say that this was edited off of the network. But
yeah, this is not on the network for obvious reasons. And you can't even edit around it. It would look so awkward with Goldberg showing up here.
Wouldn't it be great if they put in Ernest Miller's theme over top of this?
I'm back! So, I mean, fuck Megadeth. This was like a 5-minute song. And this ended up being one of the lowest quarter hours in Nitro history.
Yeah. And I mean, I feel like...
For Goldberg's return.
Yeah. Well, listen, like, I think musical acts are fine once in a while, but I feel like they're very alienating to people who don't necessarily like a band. I mean, all wrestling fans, if you're watching a wrestling show, you like wrestling, but not every wrestling fan is going to like Megadeth. Not every wrestling fan is going to like the No Limit Soldiers. It's even like SNL. I mean, it's a tradition, but like often I find like the musical act to be the part of the show where I feel like if I don't like the musical act, I'll tune out, you know, because I know it's like 5 minutes of time that I might or might not be entertained by. And I think with wrestling, it's the same. But I feel like they've got kind of, at least the WWE, they've kind of gotten away from it in recent years.
And WCW was just so hung up on these. I mean, even after a segment like this that bombed in the ratings, a month and a half later, they had Kiss, and they paid $500,000 for Kiss to come play.
Somebody back there was a fan, you know? Some exec just probably loved the idea, probably loved seeing a free Kiss show.
So at the end of the song, the pyro goes off and a monstrous-looking Bill Goldberg appears without a shirt with "I'm Back" playing over the loudspeaker. And for a time, this was Goldberg's entrance music, which I thought, like, don't fuck around with one thing in WCW that does work, and that is Bill Goldberg. And they changed this song briefly here to "Crush Him" by Megadeth.
Yeah, so did, like... So you're saying, like, this actually hurt Megadeth?
No, I'm saying it was a bad idea Goldberg.
And that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Like, if you're trying to promote Megadeth, I don't know if this was the best way to do it. In fact, you kind of made people wish Megadeth didn't ruin Bill Goldberg.
Yeah, Dave Meltzer had this awesome line. I was going back in the Observer covering this, and his line was... when it comes to the ratings, the Megadeth segment was exactly that. So, a real botched return for Bill Goldberg, who no question was the most over character in 1999 in WCW.
We should mention, this was the exact reason why we chose this show.
I know.
Like, we were debating last week, oh, Goldberg's back. What's a big Goldberg show we haven't done yet? And so... I mean, I think the people are partially to blame for this, John, because we did put it out to a Twitter poll, and people chose the Nitro return from the Georgia Dome. Maybe people mistook it for a different Georgia Dome show. But anyway,
well, if you're disappointed, we have reviewed that same Georgia Dome Finger Poke of Doom Nitro.
Yeah, so anyway, we're like, oh, okay, great. People want to hear this one. I can't wait to see the big reaction Goldberg gets in this show. And the guy wasn't even on the network version, and the version that he was on, it was like a 2 second return. So what came out of this? What happened after this?
So he came back, and just looking this up, like, I'm 99% sure he wasn't even on the pay-per-view. No, he wasn't on the pay-per-view. So why? Let's bring him back on the go home show. Like, I get it's the Georgia Dome, but still. So then, his first pay-per-view match back was at Road Wild. And I'll give you two guesses who he had a singles match with, Way. One of your standouts on this show.
Jerry Flynn.
Rick Steiner.
Oh, okay. Great.
Should have faced Van Hammer.
Yeah.
Yes. So that was it. He was back and getting primed for a match with Rick Steiner the next month. So that's great.
I guess we should really appreciate this Brock Lesnar run that he's having.
Yeah, for all of what is made about how the WWE botched Goldberg the first time as compared to WCW 97-98 with Goldberg, I mean, this run blows away Goldberg 99-2000. Blows it away. Mm. I mean, they were just... Goldberg was their one piece of currency that they really just, I mean, God, they turned this guy the next year into a heel. It was just, it got worse for this poor guy. Main event was, we have Michael Buffer in the ring, and he says, this past weekend, the United States celebrated 223 years of independence, and tonight we celebrate the rematch of the two best big men in professional wrestling today.
What?
I put these two celebrations 1A and 1B when it comes to the average American in July of 1999.
It's not
223 years of independence and a Nash Sid rematch. My question is, after Michael Cole called Braun Strowman the best big man he's ever seen, is Braun Strowman a better big man than Kevin Nash and Sid Vicious? Rank them 1, 2, and 3 way.
I mean, Braun's so new. Are we talking in-ring?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, he's the best. Yeah. I think he's already the best. Yeah. I mean, Nash had great matches with Shawn, but I'm sure Braun Strowman could have a better match with Shawn at this.
See, that's what we haven't seen with Braun. Sid and Nash have demonstrated the ability to be carried in matches with superior talent that we have yet to see Braun have that match with yet.
But I think,
like if him and AJ were to have a match, I'd still be confident that match would be more than passable.
I think so too.
But that remains to be seen. Sid and Savage walk out first. No music for Sid, who is wearing the title and is joined by Medusa and Miss Madness, a young Nora Greenwald, the former or future Molly Holly. And Shivani explains that they took the title. So in turn, Nash took Gorgeous George to set up our babyface heel dynamic.
They're the same. They're both objects of value.
I'm surprised WCW didn't like change the valets into the championships. Like you get to carry around the woman.
Right. Yeah. For 72 hours.
Or permanently.
Right.
I mean, you could have matches.
They could be a weapon in a pay-per-view. Tables, ladders, and valets.
Kevin Nash against Sid Vicious. God, all I could think about seeing Randy Savage, here was a man that was really struggling with the number 46 being his age.
Sure.
Like he didn't know how to attack 1999, and he did it with like awful fashion, hair plugs, and excessive tanning. Nash himself was going to be turning 40 later this week, so that's always a tough one. Nash gets on the mic and in such a diplomatic fashion told the broads to take a hike with Randy Savage if they ever want to see Gorgeous George again. The crowd chanted Goldberg, praying that they had paid money for his return to see a lot more than they already had. He would not return. So Savage leaves with the women. Nash then clotheslines Sid to the floor, who lands on his feet. Savage then just runs back and attacks Nash. And Nash has to fight both Sid and Savage. There's a side slam to Sid, and then the referee just stands and watches all of this. We got an awful referee bump with Savage pulling Billy Silverman in between him and Nash as Nash runs into him. Then a fake Sting runs down to a massive reaction. Shivani isn't sure if it's the real one. It's not. And then Savage has a delivers a belt shot as the fake Sting attacks Nash. Oh, my God. Then the real Sting runs down to confront the fake Sting, clearing the ring. He helps Nash up, but Nash, thinking the real Sting is the fake Sting, attacks the real Sting because the fake Sting had attacked Nash. So now the real Sting, who's teaming up with the real Kevin Nash on Sunday, has been laid out by his partner. And then Nash announces Gorgeous George is in his dressing room. What's left of her?
What's left of her is in the dressing room.
So Savage storms to the back, and we have a shot overhead of this audience that is saying, I will never come to a WCW show again. Sting goes to the back just looking puzzled. Shivani casually notes their tag match will be the main event of Bash at the Beach. That is the one and only mention of Sunday's main event on this show as Sting is walking to the back. Savage then finds Gorgeous George in the back, and he yells if Kevin Nash touched her. Tori is laughing at Savage, so Savage slaps Tori in the face and then throws Gorgeous George down a hallway, threatening to smack Tori as we go off the air with George yelling, this was awful.
No, I
Yeah.
We were doing a domestic violence angle.
Don't even think it was really an angle. I think it was like, did they follow up on the repercussions of, you know, Randy Savage laying his hands on a woman afterwards?
They did a deal where Gorgeous George, I think, showed up with a black eye later. And then ultimately, Gorgeous George got back together with Savage.
Oh, okay. So I guess they were insinuating that after the cameras shut down, Savage beat her up, basically.
I believe so. I'm looking up this angle for clarity's sake. TSN edited this angle off, the closing angle.
Thank God. Thank you, TSN. Thank you for doing that. I think that's responsible, actually, because
This was uncomfortable to watch.
Yeah, it wasn't enjoyable. And I don't know. It just it didn't feel like it belonged in a pro wrestling show. Didn't feel like an enjoyable viewing
show. Period.
Yeah. The match was pretty awful. Like, no finish. Just a bad... It's not a good time. I didn't have a good time.
That's a great way to summarize this show. I didn't have a good time. So, Bash at the Beach, Sunday. There was also a Thunder show in between here and Bash at the Beach. I couldn't imagine wanting to come back and watch Nitro 3 nights later. But there you have it. That was Nitro. This WCW franchise was plummeting at this point, but still drew 19,456 paid and a gate of almost $600,000. Things would change. It would get worse.
Yeah, I feel like a lot of that is just out of habit, you know? And I think people will continue to watch wrestling all the way up until they've really had enough. And I guess maybe the consistency of shitty shows like this over the next year was enough.
So as we just looking here to see the description of how this.
How many people do you think are still with us right now?
Probably as many as were. I wonder if there was a drop off, much like January 4th to July the 5th, 1999, at the Georgia Dome. I'm just looking at this card for Bash at the Beach, and it looks terrible. Buff Bagwell won the boxing match. Third round, 36 seconds, so they didn't go 10 rounds.
Okay.
All right. Well, that was Nitro.
I'm sorry, man. I'm sorry.
It's okay, Whit.
I just don't feel good. I feel just dirty. Like I need a long shower, and I just need to think.
Well, we have a grand total of one person who wanted to chime in with their feedback here, so I'm going to read it real quickly. This is from James. An okay Nitro with a decent mix of good and terrible, but some very funny unintentional humor. Opening package featuring a Batman-esque fight between Sid Fake Sting. Okay, he's going segment by segment here. You know what? I don't even have it in me. He gives us 5 sleeveless leather vests out of 10. This is like a recap of the show with all of his thoughts about most of the segments. So, James, thank you for watching this, but it's just too much for us at this time. I give this show a 1 out of 10 for the 6-man match with what would be the Radicals against the Jersey Triad. That is where my 1 comes from. I enjoyed Ric Flair singing, and... That's about it.
Okay.
That's my 1. That's my justification for 1. Do you even go that high?
No.
Oh, and the West Texas Rednecks. I give this a 1.5 out of 10.
I give it 0.00000000006.
Oh. So you could round that up to a 1.
No, you can round it to a 0.00000000001. You can't round it to a 1. It's far from a 1.
Well, to a 10 would be what I meant.
So good luck counting those zeros, Brad, when you update the archive.
Uh-oh. Are you sure you got them verbatim?
I don't know.
For
each? I have no idea, but this was a tougher one. So thanks, John. This, I haven't had an experience like this in a while. I just kept falling asleep throughout the show. It was boring. I had to, like, and that's the worst, when I fall asleep, because I have to go back to watch it. So some of these segments, like the David Flair versus Buff Bagwell, I had to watch like three times. And even after watching three times, I'm so numb, I have nothing to say about it. It's just like, it's just shit that happens. And then it's just shit that takes up my time. And it's shit that, like, is gross. It's just disgusting. You know, it's just nasty TV of like hero kidnapping a woman, we're led to believe has raped her, and then now the woman actually, we're led to believe, has liked it. And so like the boyfriend is now going after the woman, blaming the woman for being raped and beating her. It's terrible.
Well, this was the Attitude Era way. This was WCW's.
It wasn't the
Attitude Era.
It was their version of the Attitude Era. I guess they saw the success of the Attitude Era, and like WCW, they took that idea further and they bastardized it even more. So anyway, I'm sorry.
It's okay, Way. That's gonna wrap it up. Our next review away, we need to do something magical to bring the joy back. And what better season for joy than Christmas? Because our next show is the annual Review Away Christmas show, which coincidentally will be coming out on Christmas Day, December the 25th this year.
Wow, is it already? Wow, geez, that's really fast.
It's in 2 weeks.
Okay, cool.
So we will be back with our Christmas Day edition of the show.
Sorry, I still have a headache. I'm in no mood to like even think about Christmas.
You have to get into the festive spirit.
Right? I don't know how.
You have 2 weeks to recover from Nitro, okay? We're going to get through this. I promise.
Oh, man. Maybe I'm just... Okay. All right.
As we mentioned on Review Raw, we are doing our annual Review Away Christmas Show Jingle Contest. Maybe you can come up with a WCW-inspired Christmas jingle. That would be a lot of fun. So it's very simple. You can submit your jingles on the Law message board, lawradio.proboards.com. We're not going to put any time limit on your jingle. Just submit it by Monday, December the 19th. So you've had 2 weeks to get these jingles ready. So Monday, December the 19th, please submit your jingles, and we will have the winner announced on the show, and we will play all of them. Way is going to fall into the spirit of Christmas through your Christmas jingles. So it's a high order, but I think everyone can meet it out there. Our listeners always come through, and we're going to make sure Way has a very memorable Christmas.
I think
now.
Yeah. Okay. I'm actually like, I'm just going to crawl into a corner right now and just cry.
Well, we're going to go out of here with the only thing we can, and that's going to be, do you want to hear some West Texas Rednecks Way? Will that make you feel better?
That would help, yes.
Okay, here it is. The West Texas Rednecks performing Rap is Crap, a cult classic from WCW in 1999, one of the only good things they did in 1999. Wei Ting is now going off to invest in some Tylenol, and I hope he returns, because this is the first time I'm really concerned he may not come back. Thank you, WCW. Thank you, Kevin Nash. Thank you, wrestling industry. You have broken one Wei Ting, but hopefully he will come back on December 25th, because that's when we will chat with you. Good night.
I like country music. I love country girls. I like Willie Nelson, and don't forget about Merle. There's only one thing that I hate, 'cause it's a bunch of crap.
hate rap. I like NASCAR racing. Richard Petty's still the king. Yeah, they call me a redneck, but you know that's a beautiful thing. There's only one thing that I hate, 'cause it's a bunch of crap. I hate rap.
Your Honor?
I'm gonna be there. I've heard a lot of crap from you. I've heard a lot of trash talking. If you wanna get it on, that's my way. I've had a lot of crazy fights, a lot of crazy cases, and I'll adjudicate this one too. So, Mr. Piper, if you and Mr. Bagwell are going to get it on, let's tee it up and get it on in on Sunday in California and Florida.
All right, all right. But you think you had trouble with Mike Tyson? Here we go again. I'll make Mike Tyson in South Park no problem. But this time, Piper's killing Penny. We'll see you at Bash at the Beach, Judge.
Rap is crap.